So I was texting you this the other day, but when I first started reading this,
I'm not from the U.S., so I was reading about Ferguson and was thinking how strange it is to read about something that is not only are you like not radicalized yet, or I was, but not part of it, not part of your world in a lot of ways. But I'm wondering if you could say a little bit, just to start us out, about the through line from something like Ferguson to the George Floyd uprising in the book.
What's up, everyone? Thanks for having me. This is awesome. I love being up here at the PM warehouse. Awesome to be here with Sarah, see people in the crowd like Andy, who played such a big role in the book. So the first question was about the through line from Ferguson to the George Floyd rebellion. And that's the preoccupation of the longest essay in the book, which gives the book its title, Every Fire Needs a Little Bit of Help. I wrote it for a publication called Endnotes. And I try to trace the kind of dialectical unfolding from the Ferguson Rebellion in 2014 to the much more general George Floyd Rebellion in 2020. And methodologically, I was paying attention to the tactical sensibilities that emerged in the streets, the things that people were doing, and simultaneously how they thought about what they were doing and how people reflected on the things that they were doing. And it's no coincidence that I describe them in that order, because one of the hypotheses of this book following Marx is that people often take action and then figure out why they did it afterwards and then try to make sense of why it was that they did the thing they did. And in both the Ferguson Rebellion and in the George Floyd Rebellion, you had large numbers of people behaving quite courageously in ways that surprised themselves. And so in terms of a through line, you know, it's a positive story from a movement perspective. From 2014 to 2020, the street movement against policing in the United States developed increasingly sophisticated tactics, tactical sensibilities, and an increasingly militant anti-capitalist analysis of what it was doing. One example that I'll use that might seem like a minor development, but I think is really important, was the tactic of de-arrest or unarrest. So if you don't know what that is, basically, if you're at a demonstration or a riot and somebody gets grabbed by the police, you have the opportunity to reverse that decision. And there's a number of ways that you can do it. You can grab the person's hand and pull them away. You can be a little bit more confrontational. But the short answer is, with a little bit of courage, you can save somebody from entering the maw of the punishment system, and you can keep that fighter on the street. In 2014, this was just emerging, and it was kind of a fringe tactic. I had the experience of like having to argue with people on quote unquote our side while you were doing it. And sometimes people were saying, no, don't de-arrest me, which is fine. That's their decision. By the time 2020 came around, it was a much more general tactical sensibility. Like, yeah, that's what you do. You see somebody getting grabbed, you stop that, you reverse that decision. And I think that went for a lot of things that were controversial: property destruction, so-called looting, and a general adversarial relationship to the police. In my experience in New York City in 2014, it was difficult to get the police chant going. 6 years later, we're in a completely different story. And now enough time has gone by since 2020 in the young people who came around during the Palestine movement at its height and the encampment movement. I can't explain to them that there was a time when it was controversial to de-arrest people, to block up, to save the police, to not cooperate with cops, politicians, school administrators, and all the rest of it. So there's a hardening kind of tactical and theoretical militancy that's been happening during those times.
Some of the things that you were just saying in that answer are making me think, like, You're talking a lot from your personal experience right now and in the book. And you make, you know, you make the point that you want to be an active participant in all of the different chapters, the different areas of the book. And I'm wondering if you could say about that a little bit before I'm going to ask you particular questions about some of the things you just talked about.
Sure. So this book, it's very personal for me. You know, I've written a lot of stuff. I have an archival history of Rikers Island that's based on archival material, political economic analysis, reading other history books. I have done things that could be accused of objectivity. This book is not one of those things. This book is based on my own embeddedness in this period of protracted political crisis, and I believe the collapse of the American social order. And I do not try to disguise my own political commitments, my own position. A lot of the essays in here are based on things that I personally witnessed, like the shooting in Kenosha. Like, I was standing right there, like in the line of fire when that happened, right? And so how would it be possible for me to speak objectively about this, right? Different movements like Occupy Wall Street and like the anti-war movement. It's like, yeah, this is like, it would be impossible for me to speak about these movements in objective terms. So instead, I chose to draw on my own kind of situatedness in these movements to theorize as much as I could beyond my own limited position. And so I did so, and again, the longest essay in the book is that's my attempt at like a kind of serious overarching political economic analysis. I drew on a lot of primary sources about the George Floyd rebellion in particular. I wrote a book with a really great comrade named Jean-Darc Accorti, who spends a lot of time up in Binghamton, called States of Incarceration. And our method for that book was to ground ourselves in the writing done by participants in the George Floyd rebellion. And there's a lot of it. There were a lot of nerds going hard in 2020 who went home and then wrote lengthy analyses of what they did and why they did it, right? And we couldn't even exhaust the body of literature, right? And so I tried to draw on a lot of that in this book. And there was also some really interesting studies done by like ACLED, the Armed Conflict Monitoring Organization. This is an organization that studies the kind of collapse of civil society in various countries around the world, which includes the United States. And they did a really in-depth study of 2020 and political violence specifically in 2020. So I brought in that stuff as much as I could. But again, each section of that essay begins with something that I experienced. And yeah.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you maybe a little bit of like story time now about three different parts of that like personal experience. I was thinking like, you know, prisons being part of the George Floyd rebellion and infiltrating the alt-right. But I'm going to go with the first one first. So like I was thinking, since I've known you for a while, about Kenosha, like that I was 45 minutes away at basically like a parade, right around the same time. Milwaukee was like, for the most part, a lot of the day-to-day was pretty chill. So I'm wondering about like your own experiences, but I'm also wondering about like what you think about in the book and what you think about now after the book about how those moments were happening really differently in different cities, even like really close to one another.
It's like a case of combined and uneven crisis. If you look at the way things broke down in 2020, it was almost like there were as many 2020s as there are towns and cities in the United States. And actually, a point that I make in this book that wasn't exactly popular with some of my friends was that the average 2020 story was not the heroics of Portland or Kenosha, or these cinematic scenes of rioting in New York and Chicago. The average 2020 story was a Black Lives Matter demo in a town that had never had a demo before, in which, you know, a few dozen brave high schoolers stood down like Hell's Angels with guns. That is a more common 2020 story than the really exciting pitched battles. And I would argue that it's actually way more courageous to have a peaceful, law-abiding Black Lives Matter demo in a red state than it is to like riot in Oakland or something. And I tried to push back a little bit against only valorizing the places where things were like really quote unquote militant. I mean, you can try to measure a moment like that in terms of like property destruction or whatever, but that's all insured, I'm sorry to say. And everything went back to normal after the proletarians cleaned up the glass. But I think the more important things that happened were the changes in people's political consciousness and the reverberations of people bringing these their changed political consciousness into their school and into their workplace and into their family. And I think what we're seeing right now with the protracted reaction to 2020, and Trump basically ran his reelection campaign, like we're gonna do 2020 again and we're gonna win this time, right? We're seeing the reaction to some very serious gains of hegemony that were made by the Friends of Human Liberation that year. So as much as, you know, I write about places like Kenosha, where it was almost like a religious experience being in this kind of Midwest any town and just rioting with like weirdo skater kids and like random proles and just, but I don't think that that was the whole story. So I think the parade that you're talking about was just as important as, you know, the people burning down the probation office and knocking down the lampposts, which apparently you can just push over and they fall over, and all the skateboarder kids knew that. They're like, yo, let us show you this, and knocked it right over. There must be someone whose job it is in that town to put them back up, and he's like the mayor's brother-in-law or something, so they'll never really cement them down.
In the way that you're just answering that, you're talking about these sort of moments of change of consciousness. So then that makes me think a little bit about the infiltrating the alt-right stuff. Since that is like a fun story in there, I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about that. And then maybe like, you know, you're talking just now about how, you know, 2020 to now, to everything that's happening with MAGA. So like, tell us a little bit about that story, because it's a fun one. And I guess what do you think about it now after, you know, everything that has happened since?
Yeah, so what Sarah's talking about is there's a chapter in here called 3 months Inside Alt-Right New York. It was a project that I did actually 10 years ago. I just ran into Daryl Lamont Jenkins and he said, man, the last time I saw you, you didn't have so much gray hair. I was like, thanks, man. Yeah, that was 10 years ago. It was right after Trump's first victory. I was on like felony probation at the time. And so when people were showing up and like fighting Proud Boys and getting arrested and stuff, I was like, oh man, I'm not sure I wanna reopen my case to be like the third person to punch this guy. It was New York, you know, the numbers were on our side. But I started listening to these alt-right podcasts because it was a real, like, it was a real hegemony moment for them. These ideas were not new. I mean, this was like the same old chauvinism, you know, that you could find in the 20th century, right? But they had packaged it into what at that moment was a fairly cutting edge format, which was these like really entertaining kind of polished podcasts that had all kinds of like in jokes, and it was this world that you could join and learn the lingo and be in this in group, and you could be edgy, and like it's kind of like being like punk, you know, you can like, you can put like 1312 on your shirt and oh, no one knows what that means except the other person who's in your thing, and it's like your little in group that you're in. And so I started listening to these podcasts and I immediately was like, oh man, I know these guys, like, I know these are just like white suburban edgelords. Like, these are my people. But like, these dudes went, whereas like I said a bunch of foul shit that I thought was funny when I was 15 and like grew out of it, Like, these dudes stayed with it and it turned into their politics. So my wager was that I could walk through the front door and I could talk to these guys and that they would accept me. And from there, I just wanted to learn as much as I could about their operation. Again, this is in New York City. I knew that they had people in New York. These are people who openly fantasize about murdering leftists and trans people and black and brown people. And I wanted to figure out how serious they were. Like, is this something that we need to be preparing for, mobilizing against? I wanted to figure out who was who and how many of them there were. I think if you come from like the like leftist subculture, it's much easier for you to understand these groups than it is for normal people. Because you see like, oh, Vanguard America. And you're like, all right, that's probably like four dudes with a website who go around putting up stickers. You know, it's like, I mean, that's kind of why we're obsessed with these people, because they're like the bizarro version of us, right? And so, long story short, I identified a weak point in their OPSEC, and I started going to these hangouts, and I started meeting all these like people from different groups. And I did what I could to figure out who was who and map it out. I'm not sure what happened, but everybody ended up getting doxxed. I don't know. I think my phone might have been tapped. And so then, you know, if you know me, you know, I don't leave anything on the cutting room floor. So I was like, all right, I'm also going to write an article about this. And I did this kind of like immersive ethnographic account of being in the alt-right. And something that I tried to emphasize in the article was just, this was not an aberration at all. This was not an extraordinary feature of American society. Like, I remember being in this bar in Midtown Manhattan with the Proud Boys, and we were all just like pounding beers, and like they started doing their little like initiation speech. Like, thankfully I don't remember it anymore, but it was just like, I refuse to apologize for being a member of the Western people who created the modern world and all this stuff. And they were doing it like really loud, and there were all these tourists like cheering. This is not like marginal to American society. And simultaneously, I talk a lot about my own experiences coming out of like white flight suburbia, and how that these are enclaves that basically reproduce the raw material for this kind of fascism. So one of the takeaways that I tried to push in the alt-right article was that you can't really talk about it like it's a small number of extremists. These are people who are just following the premises of the United States, and specifically the white male experience of the United States, following that to its fairly dark, depressing, nihilistic conclusion.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if you can like talk a little bit more about the Iowa Bluffs piece and going to the Trump rally. Like, how do you see those other pieces that you've written as being related to that? How does it continue? How is it making you think about the right? What people are going to read it? What should they think about it from that?
Iowa Bluffs is an essay in here. It's my favorite thing that I've ever written, for whatever that's worth. It was like a little assignment that I gave to myself. If anyone listening to this is like trying to find their footing as a writer, I'll happily talk to you, right? Over the years, I've given myself all these like little like writer assignments, you know? And one of them was like, okay, I am going to rent a car and drive to a Trump rally in Iowa. And no matter what happens, I'm going to write an article about it. Sometimes this doesn't work because nothing happens and you have to like kind of your way through it. But in this case, I had a really interesting experience. I learned the history of the settlement of that particular part of the United States, the kind of perfidious ways that the European settlers were able to separate the indigenous people from their land. And I spent a lot of time at this casino that was near the convention center where they had the Trump event. And I learned the history of that particular land development scheme and how it had effectively become the engine of the local economy. And then when it came time for Trump's speech, the opening speaker was this local sheriff who came out and he said, you know, I just want you all to know that every town is a border town, right? This was the beginning of his most recent campaign. And he was really going hard on immigration, even more so than before. And it ended up being a winning bet for him. But the line is, every town is a border town. And you know, this was my third Trump rally. And I have to admit that the spectacle is so profound at these things that it's really hard to know what you're looking at. I had done an earlier version of this where I said, I'm gonna go see Trump in Wisconsin. And no matter what happens, I'm gonna write an essay about it. And the essay actually kind of sucked because I wrote about, like, I was like, this is just a celebrity. This is like a famous person who goes to these like podunk towns and everybody's psyched that there's a famous person there, right? It's kind of like Lady Gaga shows up in your, you know, any town USA. And there actually was a component to that, but that's not a good political explanation, right? Obama's famous. And so I was looking around this big convention center, you know, and the room was only half full. And of course, Trump came out and said, I'm so sorry to everybody who didn't get in. I'm like, it's like, man, these people know there's nobody outside. They don't give a fuck, right? And anyway, it slowly dawned on me that I am at a rally for aggrieved settler colonists. Like, there's a particular way that these people are relating to owning small pieces of property in which they are beset by the natives who refuse to die, right? And not only are they refusing to die, but they're coming back. And there's this nefarious foreign presence. It's there when your child goes to school and learns that trans people exist. It's there when you turn on the TV and you have to see like an interracial couple on like a Sprite commercial. You know, it's it's everywhere. And specifically, it's there when Latinos come to your town. And I spun that into the kind of Iowa Bluffs piece where it's my attempt at integrating the kind of the colonial history of the American Midwest with this enduring kind of settler colonial anxiety that is at once fantastic, right? But also very real. I mean, these people, the people who are most activated by Trump in so-called Middle America have poured their entire lives into small pieces of land in a moment of profound economic instability. And so just because they're blaming their problems on these kinds of this kind of political phantasmagoria of the evil other doesn't mean that there is not anything to be anxious about, right? It's just being directed at this kind of these old tropes of the immigrant, the terrorist, the drag queen reading a story to your child at the library, which Trump has done a very good job of weaving into this kind of singular character of like the alien other who's coming to your town. So I don't want to spoil the rest of the essay because it is my favorite thing I've written and I want you all to read it. And if you don't want to buy the book, that's fine. Just Google the title. It's online. You know, sorry, guys.
I was going to ask you another question about border towns, but I won't. But, you know, this is like making me think of getting into the more like pop and mass culture stuff in the book, which is awesome. You talk about Furiosa, Hellraiser, going to see the Misfits, and The Walking Dead. But in the one about Furiosa, you bring up some of this stuff about border towns and thinking about sort of the role that land might be playing in your analysis of that particular kind of media.
Yeah, that's you make an appearance in that essay. This is a recurring theme. That was another one where I was like, all right, there's a new Mad Max movie coming out. I'm gonna go see it. And no matter what happens, I'm gonna write an essay about it. Again, if you're an aspiring writer listening to this, if you notice a theme, there is a theme. So I went and saw the new Furiosa movie. And then, as one does, I immersed myself in the voluminous body of writing about the Mad Max franchise. There is an unreal amount of writing about Mad Max going back to the 1980s. And it's one of those things where at first glance, it's funny. It's just like, oh my God, cultural studies is such a grift. Like, this is hilarious, you know? And then the more you read it, you start to realize like, no, there's so much going on in these movies. They can be analyzed from 1,000 different directions. These are European settlers in Australia imagining themselves as the survivors of some ill-defined apocalypse who have effectively become indigenous and have reverted to a tribal society. Meanwhile, there's no indigenous people at all. There's no Aboriginal Australians in the
map. And their imagined idea of a tribal society.
You know, exactly. I'm glad you added that. It is like a kind of 20th century white settler paranoid version of a tribal society. Like if you watch The Road Warrior, it's basically a Western where the evil gay motorcycle gang, the Smegma Crazies, are cast as the Indians. And they've actually circled this little settlement and they're riding their motorcycles around the settlement. And so I became obsessed with these movies. And there was actually a really interesting essay written by this woman who was an extra in Beyond the Thunderdome, who went on to be a post-colonial theorist.
Good trajectory.
And she argued very persuasively that Mad Max had actually functioned in the discourse of disappearance around indigenous people in Australia because it had created this enduring mythology in which the Europeans were the indigenous Australians. And so I approached the Furiosa movie basically, first of all, thinking, how am I going to add to this? You know, it's like there's already been so much written about this. But I wanted to give George Miller the benefit of the doubt because there's actually some really intelligent stuff in the Mad Max movies, specifically around the automobile and what it has done to society. You know, because I do not think that Mad Max is like a pro-car franchise. You know, if you're like a gearhead or a hoon, as they say in Australia, if you're a hoon head, it's pretty easy to read Mad Max as like, oh, these are movies about why it rules to like blast your engine all night and like ride around in circles and, you know. But it's actually like a fairly intelligent critique of car culture and the violence that the automobile does to the landscape and the violent way that the automobile has transformed our society into so many monadic individuals at war with each other, at war with nature, unable to do anything, unable to go to the store, to go see their friends, to even go to the park without taking on an active role in the destruction of the ecosystem. It's really unbelievable what a scourge the individual automobile is on the entire planet, both socially and ecologically. And I think there's a lot of that in Mad Max. It's a view of a world where humanity has destroyed the planet and still doesn't know what to do. And all that's left is to fight over gasoline. And the only reason that you want the gasoline is so you can continue fighting over gasoline and driving in circles and revving your engine. And so I tried to bridge those two parts of the Mad Max story. And the conclusion that I came to was basically that George Miller had put together a fairly honest assessment of Euro-American society's inability to find its way out of problems of its own making. Industrial capitalism has created this world that nobody really believes in. It's the reason why apocalyptic film and literature is some of the most popular in our time. Nobody really believes that there's any kind of future worth having. At the same time, nobody knows what to do. And the interesting part about Mad Max is it tells this story so compellingly and so honestly and so purely. But as I conclude, the answer is fairly obvious, and it lies in what has been omitted. Because Miller has erased the actual indigenous Australians, and he has erased conceptions of society that do not rely upon the destruction of the environment, that do not rely on just macho violence for its own sake, and that actually value the preservation of nature and cultivate a spiritual relationship with nature where you would never privilege convenience over the destruction of the planet that your grandchildren are going to have to inhabit, right? And so that is my 10,000 word essay on Mad Max.
I think this might be the last question I ask, because I want to leave time for people to ask you questions.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm going to kind of like go in a different direction, sort of, maybe. So maybe cars are the scourge and like prisons are too. So when we
think... That's a good transition.
Thanks. But, like, you know, when you're saying that something has to be erased to be able to present this picture, I think that really comes up in what you write about Rikers and your own experiences, is that boredom is erased.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit about that part of the book before we turn to questions.
Sure. So this is a part of the book that Sarah's talking about, that I have a series of essays about the Rikers Island penal colony in New York City, based on my research into its history and my own very brief experiences being locked up there. And actually, the most personal thing that I've ever written about it comes in the form of a review of Lil Wayne's Rikers memoir. It's in here. It's called Days Spent Doing Too Much of Nothing. That's not his book. His book is called Gone Till November. And in reviewing Lil Wayne's book, I kind of enter into a critical dialogue with other anti-prison activists, specifically around the question of boredom. Because Lil Wayne, because he's a celebrity, he was able to publish, more or less unedited, his journal from when he was a prisoner at Rikers. And it's the most boring book I have ever read in my life. It's just like every day he does the same thing. He gets really excited over like, oh, I got a real Gatorade today. That was awesome. You know, oh, this is so cool. I like kicked some dude's ass at like poker. Like, this was great. Oh, I listened to the radio last night. I heard my own song. Isn't that cool? You know, it's just, it's like stuff that wouldn't even be interesting as like tweets, but it's like a book. And so when I read it, I was like, this is the most boring book I've ever read in my life. And then I was like, wait a minute, look at the subject matter. He's writing about the most boring experience that I have ever had, which is being locked up as a sentenced prisoner at Rikers, where you just kind of sit around all day just trying to make something out of nothing. And the materials at your disposal are pretty sparse, right? And so I kind of pulled at that thread. I thought, you know, so much of the propaganda against prisons rightfully emphasizes spectacular violence, sadistic guards, and nefarious prisoner subcultures, and sexual assault, and, you know, all this really bad stuff that does happen. But I'd be willing to bet that the average experience of an incarcerated person in the United States is a lot closer to Little Wayne's than something that you might see in like Oz or something. You know, it's like getting locked up is just boring and there's nothing to do. And like when you do activism around prisoner labor, sure, there's some places where prisoners don't want to labor and they're forced to. But there's a whole lot of places where prisoners want to work because they want something to do all day and they want to get out of the prison and they want to be able to circulate contraband and like see their friends and like actually do something all day, right? And so I argue that boredom is actually a feature of incarceration that anti-prison activists need to take up, because you're not simply dealing with naked violence, the sadistic guard, you know. You're dealing with abandonment, the abandonment of millions of people into a world where there is nothing constructive whatsoever for them to do, and their lives are simply being wasted. And an incarcerated person does not need to be beaten up by the guards or preyed upon by their fellow prisoners in order for their situation to be deplorable. And so I think this is an instance where activists might overstate the case. And in the process, they've ceded the ground to prison reformers who just want to make things, you know, nicer and safer and more comfortable. And I think that even a totally normal day in a perfectly safe, nice Northern European prison, it's still just a waste of someone's time, and it's a waste of the most precious thing that somebody has, which is the remaining time in their life. And that's how we need to think about it. So that's what I was able to extract from Lil Wayne's book. I hope he appreciates it, because I'm sure that was the only good review that thing got.
All right, well, I have more questions, but I think, first of all, let's thank Jared.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. It's so nice to see you.
And I don't know, I'm going to turn the floor to questions.
I have two questions. I'll let you pick one. One is about that last point you were making about boredom and the prison system. And the other question would be about insurrectionary theory and racial segregation. So take your pick.
Would you like to clarify either of those?
Okay, so the first one would be the way that boredom functions as, you know, like a oppressive feature of our society in the prison system, but also outside of the prison system and how they link together. The second one would be the way that from Ferguson to George Floyd, there's been sort of like an insurrectionary theory on the street level about like the tactics and what we're doing when we fight on the street, but also there's a racial segregation in how that is communicated and understood. And I can get into more, but take your pick of the two.
Can I just do both? Because they're great questions. I'm gonna do both. Is that okay?
Okay. I'll start with the prison society thing.
Yeah.
So you point out just how boredom is the punishment, right? What are the linkages in your mind between how that functions on the inside versus that on the outside as a feature of like not just white flight in suburbia and like the separation of how we have our defined little spaces, work, home, and the city, which is, you know, unavailable to us. What do you think are the biggest linkages from the inside and the outside in terms of boredom as control?
Okay, so I'll tell you what I did with that argument. It's a basic communist critique of wage labor, just applied to incarceration. So what do we hate about capitalism? Do we hate the fact that it's unfair? Do we hate the fact that most people don't get a fair shake, that the bosses are mean and the cops are mean and you get hurt at work and you don't have health care? These are all aspects of capitalism, but what's at the center of it? It's the separation of human beings from their life activity, right, in the form of wage labor. And so to my mind, that's the linkage, because I basically applied that to incarceration, right? What do we hate about incarceration? Oh, yeah, the guards are jerks. Some of the guards are cool. I did this book called City Time with my buddy David Campbell, former political prisoner. And he tells the story of this guard who used to play Xbox with him. And he was just like, yo, you know, I got locked up one time too. And he's like, yeah, sure. Then a year later, David picks up the newspaper and this dude just got indicted for smuggling drugs into Rikers. And so now he's writing letters to his old CO. So yeah, so do we hate prisons because the guards are mean? Because people get assaulted, right? I mean, those are aspects of it. But no, you're literally disfiguring humanity, right? You're putting people in a position where they're just completely alienated from the full development of their human potential, right? So I think you could apply that very easily to just about anything. And it's the difference, basic difference between a reformist position and a radical position. That one was easy. The second one, which I think I can do, it is profoundly uncomfortable for me how, I don't want to say white because that erases people, how non-black the insurrectionary left is. And it becomes particularly icky around things like 2014 and 2020, which were black-led, though by no means purely black insurrectionary moments. And I think the source of the color line that you have correctly identified runs deeply throughout American history. And it is precisely this. On the one hand, you have the Euro-American demand to be free of the law. And on the other hand, you have the historical black demand to be recognized by it. And that divide is not destiny, but it explains the dogged loyalty that many working class, middle class African Americans have to the American project that can baffle so many white leftists who have imagined that African Americans share their nihilistic aspirations. Like, it's almost like you talk, I can understand, because I used to be somebody like this. Like, I just could not understand why there were any black people who didn't just want to destroy America. But historically, there's decades, centuries of hard work in the African American community to gain representation within the system, protection from white vigilantism and from the government, and to receive recognition in the eyes of the law. And I think the final thing is actually white vigilantism itself. Because, you know, when the George Floyd Uprising book came out, I had a really uncomfortable moment sitting around in this room filled with non-black people banging their head against the question of why didn't more black people want to destroy their neighborhoods and all of their infrastructure with no plan in 2020. Like, that was the question. Like, why don't they get it? Why don't they understand that's what we need to do? And I think that white radicals need to understand the history of rioting, of extra legal mobs, vigilantism, is a history that's well known in black America, and it's not something that people are happy about, right? The way that, like, a lot of white radicals, like, fetishize, like, riots and direct actions outside the law and stuff. I mean, talk about the destruction of Black Wall Street, talk about race riots, talk about lynchings, right? I think that that's the connotation that that kind of politics has in a lot of black communities. And quite frankly, when you show up in a black neighborhood with a bunch of white people dressed up like ISIS and start smashing everything, you're really not doing much to dispel that stereotype. So, two great questions, and I hope I at least touched on each of them.
All right, go to Andy. The mic, Andy.
Wait, does Andy count? He wrote the preface of this book.
My question is, tell us about the preface.
Well, you can come to our table and chat about that after this. We got the book for sale. Looking back on anti-fascist activity and Trump 1.0, what do you think about the current moment? Do you think that there is an Antifa moment now? Do you think like the kind of resistance to ICE is a type of anti-fascism, or do you think it's a kind of different moment altogether?
I mean, it's definitely a different level altogether. To put yourself in the mind of the enemy for a minute, right? If you're a fascist right now, are you gonna get together with your buddies and shoot guns in the woods in Minnesota and like Sieg Heil at a tree? Or are you gonna join ICE? That's a no-brainer, right? This is a moment where the extra parliamentary right is having a waning love affair with the federal government. And I don't think I'm being overly optimistic to say that it is waning. I don't think our version of anti-fascism, like millennial anti-fascism, really makes a great deal of sense in the face of the second Trump administration, when there's really virtually no daylight between the extra parliamentary right and the federal government. But I think that arrangement is not gonna last much longer. Like, all the serious fascists have turned on Trump. They're not getting anything out of it anymore. God, we were so fortunate that it wasn't a better fascist who came along, because he's impulsive. He doesn't believe in anything. He seems to be going through some kind of cognitive decline. He keeps shooting himself in the foot at every juncture. And I think that we can reasonably expect to see the reemergence of an extra parliamentary right as a street force probably in the near future. And at that point, you know, you can dust off your copy of the PM Press three-way fight anthology, and you can refamiliarize yourself with the theory of fighting as communists against fascists and the system.
So just before we close here, I've got one last question for you, and that will be how we wrap up. What was it like seeing the Misfits, which is in the book?
I don't know. I wasn't alive in 1983, so I haven't seen the Misfits, but I did see Jerry Only, Doyle, and Danzig playing those songs together. And it was the coolest experience of my whole life. It was so sick. You know, I've seen a lot of those old reunions, the old punk band, hardcore band reunions, and they can be so depressing, you know? The most dangerous part of any of those sets, of course, is the space between songs, when the vocalist decides to deliver their offbeat take on current events. And you're standing here saying, you know, man, it's been a long time since I got my politics from punk, but please don't make me sit through an All Lives Matter speech. I really just want to mosh for your band. The Misfits was surreal. Those are some of the greatest songs ever written, you know, and I have a long essay about the Misfits in the book. They are the contradictory ambiguity, kind of just the id of American society, or at least kind of white suburban American society. And just jumping into that with both feet was just so fun. And I just, oh my God. But at the same time, it reminded me of why I study this stuff, right? Because it was just, it was also uncomfortable and real. And I have this really vivid memory of when they were playing Horror Business. This dude in front of me, this like kind of bro-y dude, was like punching his chest really hard and screaming, "I'll put a knife right in you. I'll put a knife right in you." And that's the song about Sid murdering Nancy. And I was thinking, damn, what does that song mean to this guy? You know, this dude's really jazzed about singing about murdering his girlfriend. Like, but here I am singing along with him, so what does that mean about me, you know? And that's, and I really want to thank PM for having us, for the organizers, for Andy, Binghamton Andy, for New York Andy, and my old friend Sarah for such great questions.
That was so nice.